Merlin drew rein as his weary horse topped out on the long ridgeline, and he gazed to the east, down the valley of the Sarm River. The Sarmon Mountains stretched away on either hand ahead of them, rising in endless green waves like an ocean frozen in earth and stone. It was the second day since they had left King Zaim's palace. The western sky was deep copper behind the mountain summits over his right shoulder, and despite the extra mounts, their pace had slowed as the horses grew increasingly weary. "What is it, Merlin?" the boy in front of him asked, looking trustingly up at him. He was almost 11, which made him not quite 10 by the calendar of murdered old Terra, and he was obviously worn out from the pace Merlin had set. For that matter, all the flesh and bloods were feeling the strain, and he knew it. But they were within less than 30 miles of the rendezvous point now. That was the good news. The bad news... "I think it's time for another rest, Davin," he told the prince. "And I need to discuss some things with Duke Corris, Tobis, and your sister." He swung down from the saddle, carrying the boy with him, then set Davin on his feet. "See if Corporal Zadwell can find you something a little easier to chew than hard tack while I talk to them, all right?" "All right," Davin nodded, then stretched and yawned and started off towards Zadwell. Merlin watched him go, then crossed to Corris and Iris. "We've got a problem," he said quietly. "What sort of problem?" The Earl's eyes narrowed and Merlin shrugged. "Whoever's in charge of chasing us is better at his job than I'd like," he replied. "We've left anyone from Talkaira well behind, but unless I miss my guess, whoever they had tracking us initially had messenger wyverns with him. Between that and the semaphore, they've managed to figure out roughly where we were headed and get around in front of us." "What makes you think that, Sajin Merlin?" Iris asked. "There's someone on the other side of the valley ahead of us with a signal mirror," Merlin replied. "I caught the flash from it just as we topped the ridge."
"You did?"
Corris' tone sharpened.
"Do you think they saw us?"
he demanded, and Merlin shrugged again.
"Trust me, my eyes are better than most, and we weren't deliberately reflecting sunlight at anyone the way they were."
He shook his head.
"No, I don't think they could have seen us, yet.
The problem is, they're down valley from us, which means they're directly between us and where we have to go. And even though the ones I spotted may not have seen us, I'm reasonably sure there are additional parties sweeping the area. I don't know if they've realized who we're out here to meet, or if they simply figure this is the valley we're going to follow to get through the Sarmons. But that doesn't really matter, does it?"
"No, it doesn't," Corris said slowly. Eyes slitted as he thought hard. "I know you don't claim to be a Sajin, Merlin," he said after a moment. "But do you think you can pick a way through for us without our being spotted?"
"Maybe yes, and maybe no," Merlin replied after a moment. "I'm positive I'd be able to spot any of them before they spotted us, but that's not the same as saying we could evade them all. If they've got the manpower to really sweep the valley, it's likely we'd end up eventually with one or more search parties hard on our trail. And good as these horses are, they're worn out. If they catch scent of us, they'll be able to run us down before we can reach the rendezvous." There was silence. Then Iris reached out and laid a hand on his forearm. "You've got something in mind, Merlin," she said softly, gazing up into his face. "What is it?"
"Well, the simplest way to keep them from chasing you is to give them something else to chase, Your Highness."
"Such as?" she asked slowly, hazel eyes locked with his.
"Such as me," he told her with a smile. "I leave you with the best and most rested of our horses. Then I take all the others right off into the mountains, attract their attention and lead them over hill and dale until they're thoroughly lost, and you've reached the rendezvous."
"I thought you just said their horses were going to be better than ours," Iris said sharply, and he shrugged.
true, but the ones I take with me won't have anyone in their saddles, and without the weight of a rider, they'll do pretty well. Pretty well isn't good enough, if there are enough other horses that do have people in their saddles chasing you, she snapped. You really are going to get along with Charlian, he observed with a crooked smile. Don't make silly jokes, she stamped her foot at him. I don't care how much a mighty warrior a Sajin is. It's not going to matter if enough of them catch up with you. And they're not going to catch up with me, Your Highness, he assured her. She glared at him and he shrugged. You might ask Duke Corris about the visit my friend Abraham paid him. For that matter, you might think about the first time you and I met, Your Highness. He shook his head. Trust me, once it gets fully dark, especially in this kind of terrain, I'll be able to slip away from them on foot without any problem. All they'll catch up with in the end is a bunch of worn-out horses with no riders. In fact, I'd love to see their expressions when they do. I wonder if I can hang around close enough to actually watch. She glared at him, obviously unhappy with his airy assurance, and he looked at Corris over her head. "She's your princess, my lord," he said. "Personally, I'm not going to be all that impressed if she decides to throw a tantrum. If she does, though, are you going to be able to handle her?" I'm not a piece of luggage to be handled. No, but at the moment you're not thinking very much like a princess either, Merlin pointed out, his tone suddenly much more serious than it had been. Even assuming they were going to catch me, which they aren't, it would be my job to lead them away and your job to make sure your brother gets to safety. Now are you and I going to have to argue about this? She locked eyes with him for another moment. Then her shoulders slumped, and she sighed. No. She shook her head unhappily. No, we're not going to have to argue about it. But be careful, Merlin. Please. Oh, I'm always careful, Your Highness. He leaned forward and, before she realized what he had in mind, gave her a quick peck on the cheek. She reared back in surprise, and he grinned unrepentantly. Just for luck, Your Highness, he assured her, and nodded to Corris, who was trying very hard not to laugh. "Take care of her, my lord." "I will," Corris promised. "Well, Tobis and I will, and while we're doing that, she'll take care of Davin." "Are you going to tell him goodbye?" Iris asked quietly. He looked at her, and her smile trembled just a bit. "He's lost most of the stability in his world, Merlin. Don't just disappear." "A good point, Your Highness," he acknowledged, and looked back at Corris. "Straight down the river, my lord. There's a waterfall about 25 miles downstream. The boats are supposed to be waiting just below it."
"And if they're not there?"
"If they're not there, my advice is to continue downriver anyway. If they're not at the rendezvous by the time you get there, they're probably still on their way. Carisian seamen don't turn back easily, you know. So if you just keep going, you'll probably run into them." "Probably isn't one of my favorite words when applied to desperate escapes," Corris observed dryly. "Despite which, that sounds like the best advice." "One tries, my lord," Merlin bowed, then straightened, looking past him at Davin. "And now, if you'll forgive me, I have to go tell a young man goodbye." "Is Sajin Merlin really going to be all right, Iris?" Prince Davin whispered urgently. He was mounted in front of Iris now, since hers was the freshest horse, and she weighed the least of any of the experienced riders. He twisted slightly, looking up at her, his expression hard to see in the rapidly fading light. "Tell me the truth," he implored. "The truth, Davy." She looked down at him and hugged him tightly. "The truth is that I don't know," she admitted. "But if anybody in the whole wide world can do this, it's probably him, don't you think?" "Yes," he said dubiously, then nodded. "Yes," he said more firmly.
"That's what I thought too," she told him with another hug. "But how is he going to make sure they follow him?" Davin demanded. "I mean, it's getting awful dark. What if they don't even see him?" "I don't know what he has in mind, Davy. But from what I've seen of Sage and Merlin, I think we can predict it's going to be something fairly spectacular." Sergeant Brace McNash stood in the stirrups so he could massage his posterior. Hardened cavalryman that he was, he'd spent long enough in the saddle over the last 2 or 3 days to last him for months. But that was all right with him. He wanted the traitorous bastards who had massacred so many of the Royal Guard. And the news that Duke Corris had betrayed his trust, actually taken Caleb of Caris' blood-stained gold and sold his own prince and princess to their father's murderer, filled McNash with rage. He hoped Bishop Mitchell was wrong, that Corris and the so-called Sage in Merlin wouldn't really cut the princes and princesses' throats rather than allow them to be rescued. Yet surely even that would be better than letting them be handed over to the heretic emperor and empress to be tortured into proclaiming their allegiance to Prince Hector's killers. And that wasn't the only reason McNash wanted them. Delphirac had suffered enough at Carisian hands without accepting the insult of an attack on the king's very castle. Not enough to massacre the royal guards who had thought they were there to protect Prince Davin. The treacherous sons of bitches had actually blown up 2/3 of the castle and set fire to the rest. King Zaymes had taken Prince Hector's orphans in out of the goodness of his heart and a kinsman's love. And his reward was to have his armsmen slaughtered and his home itself destroyed? No, that couldn't be allowed to stand, and it wouldn't. Not with the pursuit so close upon them. "And the bastards don't know their ride isn't coming either," he thought with grim satisfaction. The discovery that the fugitives were headed for the Somme Valley, where the West Somme flowed through the gap between the Trevor Hills and the Salmon Mountains proper, had made sudden sense out of the mysterious boats which had clashed with a troop of Duke Charles' dragoons 2 days ago. Clearly this plot had been organized far in advance with plenty of forethought, but that didn't mean it was going to work, especially not when the boats they were counting on to rescue them had turned back the day before yesterday. McNash smiled in satisfaction. The dragoons had suffered heavy casualties, but the Carisians had been even more badly hurt. Their boats had been observed headed back downriver, heaped with wounded, running with their tails between their legs. Moving with the current, they had easily outdistanced any pursuit, unfortunately, and it wasn't like there were any warships or galleys on the river between them and Sarmath, so their escape was virtually certain. But they'd managed it only by cravenly abandoning the people they'd come to meet. Still, what more could you expect out of heretics and blasphemers? Out of people who cut children's throats as blood sacrifices to Shanwei? McNash had read every word of the confessions the Inquisition had wrung out of the Carisians the port of Thirsk had handed over for their rightful punishment, and he'd been horrified by their crimes and perversions, but not surprised. After all, Delphirac knew what Carisians were like. In fact, Delphirac knew better than anyone else, given what the bastards had done to Farad. "I wonder if they've got any sort of fallback plan," he mused. "I don't know where they expected to meet those boats, but assuming they managed to get past the patrols, ha, as if that were going to happen. They're bound to realize eventually that they've been left high and dry. So what do they do then? Try to head cross-country all the way down to Sarmath on horseback? Fat chance. We'd be on them in—" Sergeant McNash's thoughts were interrupted by the arrival of a .45 caliber bullet launched from one of the first two cap-and-ball revolvers ever manufactured on the planet of Safehold. It struck him squarely at the base of the throat at approximately 1,100 feet per second, driven by 60 grains of black powder, and blew out the back of his neck, knocking him back across his horse's rump. He hung there for a moment, then thumped heavily to the ground, and his companion shouted in confusion as more gunfire rang out through the darkened mountain woods. There had to be at least a dozen attackers. Obviously the collision had been as unexpected for them as for Sergeant McNash's patrol. The shots came in rapid succession, but they'd have come in a single, concentrated volley if the traitors had realized they were about to run into the pursuit. Three more of McNash's troopers were hurled off their horses, and a fourth swayed, wounded but sticking to his saddle, and they heard voices shouting to one another in alarm. Then they heard the thunder of hooves as the fugitives turned, spurring their weary horses away from the patrol.
"Nixon, see to the wounded!"
Corporal Walter Zud shouted, reasserting command.
"Zoshua, you're on courier. Get your ass back to the colonel. Tell him we're in contact and pursuing to the northwest. It looks to me like they're breaking back the way they came."
"On my way, Corp!"
Private Zoshua responded as he wheeled his horse around and slapped his spurs home.
"The rest of you, after me!"
"Might show him, my lord," Tobias Raymere said judiciously, watching the lurid stab of pistol fire on the far side of the valley.
"Perhaps a little,"
Corus allowed, holding one hand out, palm down, and waggling it from side to side.
"Effective, though."
"Wonder how many he winged this time," Raymere said. "I mean shooting from a horse. Critter has to be spooked, what with guns going off in its ear for the first time, and in the dark and all, with no lanterns. Has to be less accurate than he was back at the palace, wouldn't you say, my lord?"
"I'm not prepared to wager against the Sajin under any circumstances, Tobias,"
Corus replied dryly.
"Will you two stop it?"
Iris demanded. "They're probably chasing him over there right this minute."
"Well, of course they are, Your Highness," Raymere acknowledged, turning in the saddle to face her. "Whole point of the exercise."
"But what if he was wrong about being able to break away from them?" Davin demanded, his voice tight with anxiety. And Raymere reached out and ruffled the boy's hair with his hand.
"You ever hear the story about the hunting hound that caught the slash lizard, Your Highness?" he asked.
The prince looked up at him without speaking for a second or two, then nodded slowly, and the sergeant shrugged.
"Well, there's your answer. I'm sure they're doing their damnedest, pardon my language, Your Highness," he apologized to Iris, "to catch up with him this very minute. And if they're dead unlucky, they will."
"We've got them now, sir."
"You think so?"
Colonel Afraim Talavir looked up from the map to arch one eyebrow at his aide. The young man was holding the bull's-eye lantern so the colonel could see the map, and he looked astounded by his superior's question.
"Well, yes, sir," he said after a moment.
"Don't you?"
"I think we've got an excellent chance to catch up with them now," Talavir replied. "On the other hand, we ought to have caught them well before now. Traitors or not, and heretics or not, this is an elusive fish, Brandon. I'm not going to count it as caught until I've netted it and got it in the boat."
Lieutenant Magowin nodded. His colonel's passion for fishing was something he had never understood, but the metaphor made sense anyway.
"The thing I'm wondering," Talavir said meditatively, tapping himself on the chin while he thought, "is whether all that gunfire was really a surprise reaction."
"I beg your pardon, sir?"
"Well, whether running into our patrol was a surprise or not, it was pretty spectacular, wasn't it? Would you care to bet a silver that every single picket and patrol out there isn't headed in the same direction right now?
If you were leading one of those patrols, wouldn't you have headed straight for the gunfire?"
"Of course, sir."
"'Spoken like a good officer in training, Brandon. "'Ride to the sound of the guns. "'That's what we teach you. "'And it's usually the right thing to do, too. "'But suppose it wasn't really all gunfire to begin with. "'Remember, these bastards blew up a sizable chunk "'of King's Aim's palace, according to the Wyvern messages. "'What if they brought along a supply of firecrackers?' One man with three or four of those double-barreled pistols the Carisians seem so fond of and a couple of dozen firecrackers to go off in the underbrush, and all of a sudden every man we've got scattered around the hills is hairing off like slash lizards that smell blood. And meanwhile... He arched both eyebrows at Magowin this time, and the lieutenant frowned. Then his eyes widened. And meanwhile the rest of them sneak right past us to the river... "'and meet up with their boat, sir. "'You really think that's what's happening? "'Frankly, what I think is almost certainly happening "'is exactly what Corporal Zud thinks is happening. "'And even if it isn't, their boats turned back 2 days ago, "'so there's no one to meet them anyway,' Talavia replied. "'But I didn't get to be a colonel by not hedging my bets. "'So what do you want me to do, sir?' Given that anyone who can see lightning or hear thunder knows about that gunfire, and that all of our good, aggressive, competent junior officers and sergeants are going to be riding to the sound of the guns, the colonel smiled at his aide. There's not a whole lot we can do. About the only people we have who aren't already wandering through the woods, hopefully overhauling the miscreants even as we speak, are Lieutenant Willems and his detachment. Yes, sir. Magowin said with a slight but discernible lack of enthusiasm, and Talavia chuckled. "'Not the sharpest pencil in the box, I'll grant, although I really shouldn't say it,' he admitted. "'That's why I put him in command of our reserves and the extra horses. It let me keep him out of trouble. Now, unfortunately, it also means he's the only one I can be sure of isn't chasing gunfire in the gloaming.' "'Yes, sir.' Talavia gazed back down at the map for several seconds, then sighed. "'It's a pity he doesn't have more men, but we are talking about a fairly unlikely eventuality. Take him a message, Brandon. He's to leave half his men to look after the remounts. I want him to take the rest downstream as far as this waterfall,' he tapped the map. "'I think it's the first real fall in the stream.' So wherever they were supposed to make rendezvous with those boats that aren't coming after all, it has to be on the far side of that, which means they have to get past it one way or the other. Tell him I want his men posted at the foot of the fall. And, Brandon, try to make him feel that I'm trusting him with this because of his competence, not because he's the only person I can send, all right? Yes, sir. Magowin tried hard not to smile. And the colonel shook his head at him. "'You're a wicked young man, Brandon. "'I foresee a great future for you.' "'Thank you, sir.' "'You're welcome.' Talavia started to wave the lieutenant on his way, then paused. "'Oh, and while you're at it, "'remind him that the King and Mother Church "'would really like to have the prince and princess back alive.' Tell him I don't want any shooting unless he's positive he knows what he's shooting at. Full night had fallen long since, and the moon was sliding steadily up the eastern sky as Toby's Raymare picked his cautious way down the steep hillside to the brink of the river. The rumbling, rushing, pulsing sound as it poured smoothly over the lip of the waterfall to the basin 40 feet below was loud in the darkness. In fact, it was a lot louder than Raymare liked. He would have preferred to be able to hear something besides moving water. "'Oh, don't be an old woman, Toby,' he told himself. "'It's worked exactly the way the Sajin said it would so far, so don't go borrowing trouble at this point.' He snorted quietly, then turned in the saddle to wave to the others before he started his horse down the rough footpath beside the river. If Sajin Merlin's description was as accurate as everything else he had told them, their ride should be waiting for them at the end of the steep switchbacks.
"'By God!'
Lieutenant Prescott Willems blurted. "By God! The Colonel was right, Father."
"Yes, it would appear he was, my son," Father Denivin Charles agreed. "We shouldn't take God's name in vain, however," he continued in a gently scolding tone.
"Yes, Father, I'm sorry, Father," William said quickly,
and Charles hid a smile at the lieutenant's well-trained response. He'd often found the kindly tutor's role most effective in controlling younger men, especially younger men who weren't particularly smart, which described young Willems quite well. But then the temptation to smile disappeared. To be honest, he'd been almost certain Colonel Talavier was sending Willems off on a wild wyvern chase. Still, there'd been the possibility he wasn't, and the sad truth was that Charles was in no position to influence whatever happened when the Colonel's dragoons caught up with the fugitives in the middle of the woods. He could only be in one place at a time, when all was said, and there was no telling which of the pursuers would actually bring their quarry to bay in the end. It would have been nice if Bishop Mitchell had authorized him to tell the Colonel what was really going on, although there was clearly a potential downside to such a revelation. Talavier was likely to balk at simply cutting the throats of a 20-year-old girl and an 11-year-old boy, no matter who told him to do it. And explaining why Iris and Davin Dakin had to die would have been getting into waters it was best to keep laymen well out of. For that matter, Charles rather doubted Bishop Mitchell had told him everything. Under the circumstances, he'd decided it made sense to attach himself to Willems. However unlikely, it was still possible Willems would encounter their prey, and the Inquisitor felt confident of his ability to manipulate Willems into doing what he wanted, especially given his status as Bishop Mitchell's special representative. That was how he'd planned on explaining his thinking to the bishop afterward, at any rate. No need to mention the fact that he rode like a sack of potatoes and that his buttocks felt scraped raw and treated with salt. And now it looked like he'd rolled treble sixes after all. "What do you intend to do, my son?" he asked. "I'm going to let them get most of the way down, then catch them on the trail, father," the lieutenant explained. "We've got the matches shielded as well as we can, so I don't think anyone's going to see them as long as we stay well back in the trees. But I'd just as soon keep them from getting too close before we move. And it's so damn dark, pardon my language, please, down here in the valley that nobody'd be doing any accurate shooting. But if I can catch them spread out on the trail in the moonlight, they won't have any choice but to surrender. I think perhaps it might be better to let them get all the way to the base of the fall before you pounce, my son," Charles said. "Excuse me, father?" It was impossible to see the lieutenant's expression in the dark, but Charles heard the confusion in his voice. "The shadows are far darker below the fall, father," Willems pointed out respectfully after a moment. "And the moonlight isn't getting to the bottom the way it is on the trail. That'd make any kind of accurate shooting even harder. And if we let them get off the trail, down here where the going is better, they might actually try to ride through us. Frankly, with my men already dismounted to use their matchlocks, there'd be a chance they'd get away with it too." Skarl nodded gravely, revising his estimate of Willem's mental prowess upward, slightly. "Those are excellent points, my son," he said. "And I'm a simple priest, of course, not a soldier. Still, it seems to me that if we let them reach the bottom, they'll have a sense of confidence at having passed the obstacle. That means the shock of suddenly discovering we're already down here waiting for them will hit even harder. I believe that's more likely to paralyze their will to fight or flee. And if they do try to break past us, your men can catch them in a crossfire as they go. I think by far the most likely outcome, however, would be that they'd realize they couldn't possibly escape back up that steep trail, and, with an unknown number of troopers between them and escape on the downriver side, they'd surrender. Assuming they'd be willing to surrender under any circumstances, at least." "I see," Willem said slowly. It was obvious to Charles that the lieutenant's instincts were at war with his advice. That was unfortunate. Still, Willems had already demonstrated his deference to the cloth, and Charles reached up and casually adjusted his priest's cap. "As I say, my son, I'm no soldier, but I'm afraid I really must insist in this instance." Willems stiffened slightly, and Charles patted him on the shoulder with a fatherly air. "There are elements of the situation of which you're not aware, my son. Please, just trust me in this." "Of course, father," Willem said after a moment, and began whispering orders to his sergeants. Charles stood back, listening and nodding in approval, while his right hand crept into the side pocket of his cassock and touched the smooth, curved wooden grip of the pistol Bishop Mitchell had provided. Tobias Raymer reached the bottom of the trail and dismounted. The basin below the fall was much larger than he had thought it was, looking down into the darkness from above. It extended well away from the rumbling smother of foam where the water crashed down into it, and he led his weary horse to the edge of the wind and current-ruffled pool, enjoying the blowing mist and letting the beast drink, but keeping one eye on it to make sure it didn't drink too much. His other eye was on the trail, watching the others make their way down it slowly and carefully, despite the moonlight, and he allowed himself a sense of cautious optimism. Still, something didn't quite smell right. He couldn't put his finger on what it was, but there was something. "You really are an old woman tonight, aren't you?" he asked himself sardonically. "You'll find something to worry about no matter what." That might very well be true, but it didn't do anything about that itch he couldn't quite scratch. Perhaps it was just that the Corisians didn't seem to have reached the rendezvous point. Well, Sajin Merlin had warned them how far the boats had to come, so it was hardly surprising they hadn't arrived yet. In fact, the truth was that even with Merlin being forced to lead off the pursuit, this entire operation had gone far more smoothly than Raymer would have believed possible after a lifetime in the army. Something always went wrong. That was the soldier's wisdom, and it had never yet failed him. He grinned, shaking his head, then looked up as Princess Iris reached the bottom with Davin before her. Duke Corris was right behind her. The rest of the men followed in single column, with Zach Maris, Reza Waltars, and Travers Zadwale bringing up the rear. "Go ahead and dismount, Your Highness," he said quietly as the princess reached him. "We should probably rest the horses again before we head on downriver. Besides, I'd like to let the moon get a little higher. It's pretty rocky down here, and the horses will need all the moonlight we can get if they're not going to break a leg." "Won't that make us more visible?" Iris asked. It was a question, not an argument or a criticism, Raymer observed, and nodded back to her. "Aye, Your Highness, it will," he agreed. "Still and all, I think we're probably past them now, given the Sajin's diversion. And, truth be told, I think it's a lot more likely a tired horse is going to put a foot wrong in bad light than that we're suddenly going to be ambushed by a batch of Delphirakan dragoons." "Sounds sensible to me, Tobias," Corris agreed, dismounting as he reached the sergeant's side. "And stand where you are," a voice shouted suddenly out of the darkness. "Throw down your weapons." Young Willems had really done quite well, Charles observed. It was a pity in so many ways that Bishop Mitchell's instructions left him with no alternative. "Down your weapons," the lieutenant shouted, and Charles heard his two sergeants ordering their men to advance cautiously. The Coruscantians were frozen, standing as if struck to stone by the totally unexpected ambush. They obviously had no idea how many men Willems had. If they'd realized how under strength the lieutenant's platoon actually was, they might have shown more fight. As it was, Willems' ambush was about to become a brilliant success, and that, unfortunately, could not be permitted. The Schulerite quietly drew the pistol from inside his cassock. He'd never used one of the Carisian-invented weapons before, but it wasn't all that complicated, and he cocked it as he stepped up close behind the lieutenant.
"It worked, Father," Willem said exuberantly, turning to look over his shoulder at the priest. "You were right. This is perfect."
"I'm happy for you, my son," Charles said, and then pressed the muzzle of the pistol against the back of the young man's skull and pulled the trigger. Tobias Raymer stood frozen by the shock of the sudden shout, cursing himself for not having listened to that inner instinct. He should have listened. And how had he missed spotting the damned slow matches? They were coming out into the open now, glowing like blink lizards, but he'd never even seen a thing before they did. He hadn't paid even that much attention to his job, had he? Oh no, not him. Instead, he'd let the girl and her brother walk straight into it, and now... Then the gunshot roared in the darkness, and the blinding muzzle flash and echoing report jerked him out of his funk. He turned towards Iris, both arms reaching out, gathered her and her brother to his chest, and flung all three of them not to the ground, but into the pool below the waterfall.
"They've shot the lieutenant," Charles bellowed, tossing the empty pistol into the river and grimacing distastefully at the blood and bits of brain matter which had blown back over his cassock. "They've shot the lieutenant."
He drew a deep breath.
"Kill the heretics." "Down, everybody down,"
Philip Osgood shouted as he heard the three-word command and knew, somehow he knew, it had come from an inquisitor's throat. Worse, the troopers out there in the dark would know the same thing, and the bone-deep reflex of obedience to the voice of Mother Church would finish what confusion had begun. A matchlock flashed, thundering in the darkness. Langhorne only knew where the ball had gone, but another fired, and then another. Inaccurate at the best of times, it would take a special miracle for one of them to hit someone at this range under these conditions. But matchlocks weren't the only weapons dragoons carried, and Corris knew what was coming.
"Why, God?" a voice demanded bitterly deep inside him. "Why did you let us come this far only to fail now?"
God didn't reply. Or not immediately, at any rate. But then...
"Take him, lads!"
another voice shouted, and someone cried out in alarm, then screamed in anguish.
"Saxon, make sure none of them get past us,"
that same voice shouted. An extraordinarily young voice, Corris realized, but one which carried a hard ring of command. Another matchlock fired, and then there was a different sound, a flintlock. A fresh muzzle flash stabbed the night, and suddenly half a dozen flintlocks went off almost as one, firing from the hillsides, upslope from and on either side of the dragoons who'd been hidden in the woods.
"Bayonets!" that voice yelled out of the darkness. "Up and in, boys! Up and in!" it shouted,
and the night was abruptly ugly with the clash of metal, the terrible wet sounds of steel driving into human flesh, with screams and curses.
"Quarter!"
someone bawled suddenly.
"Quarter, sweet Langhorne, quarter!"
And then, that abruptly, it was over. Silence fell, broken only by the crash and surge of the waterfall and the whimpers of the wounded, and Corris stood very slowly in the fragile stillness. Other sounds began returning to the night, as if creeping cautiously back into it, and he heard rough, sharp voices ordering surrendered men to their feet, herding them together, taking their weapons. It would, he decided, be prudent to remain where he was and avoid any misunderstandings until that process was completed, and his eyes narrowed as someone stepped out of the darkness into the moonlight. It was difficult to be certain in such poor light, but the newcomer certainly looked as if he wore the uniform of a Carisian naval officer. although it was obviously somewhat the worse for wear. He paused and cleaned his sword on the tunic of a fallen dragoon, then sheathed the weapon with smooth, economical grace. Corus was still staring at him when he heard a splashing sound. "If you don't mind, Philip," Iris Dakin said tartly, her teeth chattering slightly, "I'd really appreciate a hand." He turned quickly, reaching down to take Dave in as she and Raymair boosted the shivering, obviously frightened boy out of the icy mountain water. The prince flung his arms around Corry's neck, clinging tightly, and the earl patted his back reassuringly. "It's all right, Davin. It's all right now," he said soothingly. "I know," Davin said in a tight voice, and nodded once convulsively, but he never relaxed his hold, and Corrus looked helplessly down at Iris over her brother's shoulder. "Allow me, Your Highness," someone else said in a pronounced Carisian accent, and the newcomer in the naval uniform was suddenly beside him, reaching down both hands to Iris. She looked up at him for a moment, then reached to take the offered hands. The Carisian wasn't especially tall or broad-shouldered, but he boosted her effortlessly out of the water. Then he reached down again and hoisted Toby's Raymair out as well. "That was quick thinking, getting them below ground level that way when the shooting started," he congratulated the sergeant. It was still a ridiculously young-sounding voice, Corus decided, but it was also crisp and decisive, a very reassuring voice, all things taken together. "Excuse me," its owner continued, turning back to Corus, Iris, and Davin. He bowed gracefully. "Lieutenant Aplin Armark, Imperial Carisian Navy, at your service. If you're ready to go, I have two boats waiting about a mile downstream from here. It'll be a little crowded." Teeth gleamed faintly in the moonlight, which was finally probing into the darkness at the foot of the waterfall. "But I believe you'll find the accommodations preferable to these." "I believe you're right, Lieutenant," Corus said gratefully. "In fact..." "Beg pardon, sir," another voice interrupted. And Aplin Armark, and did that name indicate this youngster was who Corus thought he was, turned towards the interruption with a frown. "What is it, Malik?" he asked in a no-nonsense tone. "Beg pardon for interrupting, sir." The other voice belonged to what could only be a professional Carisian petty officer. "But I think this is important." "And what exactly is this?" Aplin Armark prompted. "Well, sir, Zaxin put the arm on this priest here when he tried to scamper off downstream," the petty officer said, dragging a prisoner into the moonlight. "And we found the officer in command of this here ambush too, sir. Seems somebody..." The petty officer kicked the prisoner to his knees, and Corus saw the priest's cap and cassock. "Blowed the poor bastards! Beg pardon for the language, Your Highness." He bobbed Iris a brief bow. "Blowed the poor bastard's brains out. 'Twasn't any of us, because from the powder burns, whoever it was shot him from behind and real up close and personal-like. And a funny thing, sir, but this here priest, he's got blood and brains splashed all over his right arm." "Does he now?" Aplin Armark said in a deadly soft voice. "I'm a priest of Mother Church," the captive thundered suddenly, surging up as he started back to his feet. "How dare you!" He went back down again, this time squealing in pain as the petty officer casually, and with brutal efficiency, stamped down hard on the back of his right knee. "A priest, are you?" Aplin Armark said in that same deadly voice. "And a servant of the Inquisition, no doubt." "A priest of any order is still a priest of God," the prostrate cleric shouted furiously, both hands clutching at the back of his knee. "And he who lays a hand on any priest of God is guilty of blasphemy." "An inquisitor, all right," Aplin Armark said, and looked past the petty officer still standing over the Shularite. "Zaxin, go find me the senior prisoner. Bring him here." "Aye, sir."
"'I tell you, you're all—'
the priest began again, and Aplin Armagh looked at the petty officer. "'Malik?' he said quietly. "'My pleasure, sir,' the petty officer said, and kicked the priest none too gently in the belly. The Inquisitor doubled up into a ball with a shrill, whistling cry of pain, and then lay grunting and gasping for breath, while the petty officer watched him with a mildly interested air. The priest was just starting to get his breath back when the man named Zaxin returned with a Delpharacan dragoon. The man had been wounded, and a rough dressing around his upper left arm was stained black with blood in the moonlight. But the shock of such abrupt defeat, when victory had seemed certain, was obviously more debilitating than any sword cut.
"'This here's the senior sergeant, near as I can tell, sir,' Zaxin said.
"'Thank you.' Aplin Armagh turned to the Delpharacan. "'Are you the senior prisoner?' he asked.
"'Aye, that I am, sir,'
the Delpharacan said. "'Leastwise, I am if the lieutenant's really dead.'
"'Oh, he's dead, mate,' the petty officer said. "'Shot in the back of the head, and from real close, too.'
"'What?' The Delpharacan looked back and forth between Aplin Armagh and the petty officer.
"'That don't make no sense, sir. The lieutenant, he was behind us. And the father said he was dead before any of you lot started shooting from the hills. I thought the shot had to come from here.'
He jabbed the index finger of his good hand at the rocky edge of the pool. "'That's exactly what you were supposed to think, Sergeant,' Aplin Armagh said grimly. "'This Shularite bastard murdered your lieutenant in order to turn what should have been an orderly surrender into a massacre. And it would have worked if we hadn't already been here keeping an eye on things and you when your lot first arrived, wouldn't it?'
"'Well, I don't know as how—'
the sergeant began uncomfortably, then stopped.
"'Aye, sir,' he admitted in a lower voice. "'Aye, it would have—' "'That it surely would.' "'This is all lies,'
the priest sputtered suddenly, still more than a little breathless from that kick in the belly.
"'Lies by heretics and blasphemers, by excommunicates. "'Sergeant, you can't take their word for this. "'Why, it probably was one of them, deliberately shooting poor Lieutenant Willems down from ambush without warning.' "'Just to discredit me. "'Is it my fault I was standing so close to him "'I was splashed with his blood when they killed him?'
"'The sergeant looked down at the priest for a moment, "'then met Aplin Armagh's eyes in the moonlight. "'He weren't the very smartest officer "'nor I ever served under, the lieutenant,' he said. "'But he were a good lad, "'and he always tried to do what was right. "'Didn't always manage it, but he tried, sir.' And in a fair fight, all the holes would have been in the front, not the back, like this. It ain't right, sir. He shook his head, his voice stubborn. It ain't right. No, it isn't, Sergeant, Aplin Armagh agreed. So I have only one more question for you.
Sir,
the Delpharacan said a bit cautiously.
This man is obviously a Shularite, Aplin Armagh said.
"'Can you confirm that he's also an Inquisitor?'
"'Aye, sir,' the Delpharacan replied. "'That he is, attached to Colonel Talavere Special by Bishop Mitchell. "'Heard him telling the Colonel myself, I did.' "'Think what you're doing, Sergeant,' the priest snapped. "'By God, I'll see you put to the punishment for collaborating with heretics. I'll—'
The Delpharacan flinched. But then his shoulders hunched stubbornly and he glared down at the priest.
"'He's an inquisitor, sir,' he said firmly. "'Sure as sure.'
"'Thank you, Sergeant,' Aplin Armagh nodded to the Delpharacan, then looked at the petty officer. "'Stand him up, Malik,' he said flatly. "'Waste of good sweat, sir,' the petty officer said. "'He'll only be back down in a minute or two.'
"'Even an inquisitor should have the chance to die on his feet, Stewart,'
Aplin Armagh replied in a voice of iron.
"'What?'
The priest stared up at him in shock.
"What did you just say?"
"You and your friend Clintan should pay more attention to proclamations coming out of Tellisburg," Aplin Armagh said coldly. "Some of those men you tortured and butchered in Zion were friends of mine, and every damned one of them was innocent. Well, the blood on your cassock says you're not, and my emperor and empress policy where inquisitors are concerned is very clear."
"You can't be. I mean, I'm a priest of Mother Church. You can't just..."
"I know priests," Aplin Armagh told him, as Stewart Malik hauled him to his feet by the collar of his cassock. "I even know a Shularite priest, a good one, the kind who truly serves God. And that's how I know you aren't one, whatever that fat, greedy bastard in Zion might say." He drew a pistol from his belt and cocked it. "If you want to make your peace with God, you have 30 seconds.
"Damn you! Who do you think you are to threaten a consecrated priest of God? You wouldn't dare!"
"You don't want to make peace?" Aplin Armagh said.
"Fine."
His hand rose, his finger squeezed, and Anivin Shal's eyes were just starting to widen in disbelieving terror when his head disintegrated. The body dropped like a string-cut puppet, and Aplin Armagh turned to Duke Corris and Princess Iris. "I apologize for the delay," he said as the muzzle smoke of his pistol wisped away on the cool, damp breath of the fall. "Now, I believe those boats are still waiting for us." February, Year of God, 896. 1. Nemu's Cave, the Mountains of Light, the Temple Lands, and Tellisburg Palace, City of Tellisburg, Kingdom of Old Caris. "So just exactly how was it you were planning to get home again without raising any eyebrows?" Caleb Armagh asked, leaning back in the rattan lounge and gazing up at a spectacular sunset. His daughter lay curled on his chest, her nose pressed into the angle of his neck, while she slept with the absolute limpness possible only for small children and cat lizards. And Empress Charlian's crochet hook moved busily as she looked across at him and smiled. "Why should I get home without raising any eyebrows?" Merlin responded over the comm plug in his ear. "I'm a Sajin, the mysterious, deadly, probably magical Sajin Merlin." There was a clearly audible sniff. "I come and go, and no man sees me pass." "You're getting remarkably full of yourself, aren't you?" Charlian inquired sweetly. "Well, I think I've done fairly well the last few 5 days," he pointed out. "That's true, I suppose," Caleb said judiciously. "I especially liked the bit with the voices shouting to each other there at the end, on top of the gunshots. No wonder they thought all of you were right in front of them." "If you've got a programmable vocoder for a voice box, you might as well use it," Merlin replied smugly. But then he sighed. "Actually, though, I think I'm blowing my ego out of my ears because I'm bored and I want to come home." Charlian looked across at Caleb, and her expression softened. "We're looking forward to seeing you at home," Caleb assured him, speaking for them both. Then he shrugged, very gently, so as not to disturb the sleeping child next to his heart. "I agree, sending you personally to oversee Iris and Davin's rescue was the right move. But having you operate openly that far away's inconvenient as hell in a lot of ways."
"I've noticed that myself," Merlin said dryly. "I'm thinking about adding a few extra members to Master Zivon's ensemble cast. It can be a pain covering for absence on my part while Zivon's, or someone else for that matter, runs around in the middle of Howard, but it saves us from having to account for all of this damned transit time."
"I see your point, but I think it was a good thing you were running around in the middle of Howard this time," Charlian said soberly, and Merlin shrugged. "I'm inclined to agree.
given my own modest contribution to getting them out of Talkeira and delivering them to the rendezvous. But Hector did pretty well himself, didn't he?
Yes, Caleb agreed. Yes, he did. Especially for someone as young as he is.
This from the grey-bearded septuagenarian sitting on the throne of Caris, I see, Merlin replied, and Charlian giggled.
All right, so I was only a couple of years older than he is now when you took me in hand, Caleb acknowledged. But he still did a damned good job.
No question about that, Merlin acknowledged, and there wasn't.
Faced with the loss of all of the expedition's senior officers, Aplin Armach had decided to continue the mission, despite the risk of additional encounters with the Delphiracan militia. So he'd transferred all his wounded into four of the six boats and sent them back downstream with orders to remain in the middle of the current as much as possible. The Somme wasn't an enormous river, but it was broad enough that troops armed with the relatively short-barreled, smooth-bore matchlocks dragoons carried would play hell trying to hit a target in midstream. Artillery would have been a different matter, but the Royal Delphiracan Army had no new model field artillery. For that matter, it didn't have very much artillery at all, and the cumbersome, slow-firing pieces it did possess lacked the mobility to intercept boats moving at the better part of 12 miles an hour under sail and oars, while the river's current worked for them instead of against them. He had also ordered the boats to travel in daylight, to make it abundantly clear to any observer that they were straggling back to Sarmath in disorder as quickly as they could get there. As he had hoped, the Delphiracans had pursued the retreating boats with their cargo of wounded and clearly dispirited passengers as vigorously as they could, all the way back downriver. Meanwhile, he and the remaining two boats had continued upstream unnoticed, moving only under cover of darkness, and with Stewart Malik's cutter towing the second boat, all but empty. Proceeding with barely 30 men was an obvious risk, but it had let him save room in the second boat for the passengers he'd intended to collect. It had also left him far shorter-handed than he could have wished when he encountered the unfortunate Lieutenant Willem's dragoons. Luckily, he had arrived at the rendezvous 15 hours before Colonel Talavir's regiment moved into the area, and he had posted pickets well out from his carefully hidden boats. They had spotted Willem's troopers moving into position early enough for Aplin Armach to arrange his own counter-ambush. Even so, he'd had to wait for the dragoons, who'd still substantially outnumbered his own people, to emerge from the woods and bunch up before he could pounce. In the end, he'd ordered the attack with impeccable timing and, frankly, the cold-blooded patience with which he had waited for exactly the right moment was even more surprising out of someone his age than the initiative, in Merlin's opinion.
What do you think about Bishop Mitchell's reaction to what happened to that poisonous piece of work, Charles?
Caleb asked after a moment.
I think it was inevitable, Merlin shrugged. I happen to agree with the policy, but it was obvious from the get-go. The Inquisition was going to take the view that all of its inquisitors were purer than the new-fallen snow, the blameless, stainless victims of those vicious, vile, Shan Wei-worshipping, baby-murdering Carisian heretics. His mouth twisted in distaste. The farther away people are from where the atrocities take place, the more likely they are to buy that line of dragon shit, too.
Owl's remotes are still getting our version tacked up on convenient walls all over both continents, but the Church is going to have the inside track when it comes to convincing the faithful for quite a while. Look at the way they're handling that business in Sidamark.
Caleb made a harsh sound in his throat, and Charlian kicked him gently on the outside of his right thigh.
"You wake her up?" she said, twitching her head in their daughter's direction. "And you get to sing her back to sleep, Caleb Armach."
"I'll be good," he promised, with a penitent smile. "But it's Merlin's fault for bringing up things like that."
Tell me you're not going to be discussing it with Travis, Binzamin and Michael first thing tomorrow morning, Merlin challenged.
But that's then, not now, Caleb retorted.
True, Merlin nodded, leaning back in his own chair deep under the far-off mountains of light.
It's going to be ugly, however it finally works out, he said somberly, and it was Caleb's turn to nod.
What I'm most worried about at this point, to be honest, is food, he said. Clintan timed it entirely too well from that respect, damn him to hell.
Agreed.
But if Stonar can hold out through the winter, our good friend the Grand Inquisitor may just find the wheels coming off his little wagon. Merlin's expression was no less somber, yet there was a note of grim satisfaction in his voice.
I think he actually expected to sweep the board, and it didn't quite work out that way, did it?
Thanks in no small part to your friend Anzelic, or I suppose we should call her Ava now.
Caleb smiled in simple admiration.
I'll guarantee you none of Clintan's agents guessed for a moment that she had 1,500 trained riflemen right there in Siddar City, which doesn't even count the 6,500 rifles hidden aboard those ships of hers on North Bay. She more than doubled the total number of modern firearms available to Stoner.
Not to mention rescuing the Lord Protector's august posterior on the very first day, Merlin agreed.
Without her, they probably would have taken the capital, you know,
and massacred every Carisian and reformist they could get their hands on, Charlian put in grimly, her eyes shadow. It was bad enough, even with her preparations, and I get sick to my stomach every time I think of what happened in so many other places.
I know, Merlin said softly.
Siddar City's Carisian Quarter was the largest, richest, and most densely inhabited in the entire Republic, but almost all of Sidamark's coastal cities had boasted their own quarters. For that matter, even the larger inland towns had been home to expatriate Carisians who'd married Sidamarkians or simply located in the Republic because of the financial opportunities. Outside the capital, most of those Carisian communities had been effectively wiped out. Even in Siddar City, despite Ava Parsan's preparations and Lord Protector Gregor's decision to divert over half his own available strength to protecting its Carisian inhabitants, over 2,000 people had been killed. Rape and torture had run rampant as the rioters slaked their hatred in the blood of their victims. Nor had they restricted their activities to Carisians. Reformist churches had been burned throughout the Republic. Reformist priests had been murdered, in some cases burned to death inside their own churches. And Reformist congregations had been killed or driven into headlong flight from towns in which their families had lived for centuries. It had been worst in the Republic's western provinces, partly because of those provinces' deep, often bitter resentment of the eastern province's greater wealth, but also because Clintan and Reno had devoted the most attention to making sure they would succeed in the provinces closest to the temple lands. There'd been some notable exceptions, however. In Glacier Heart and Cliff Peak, the militia had turned on the insurrectionists and rabble-rousers in its own ranks and crushed the uprising within days. The same thing had happened in Icewind Province, although the situation looked much grimmer there. No one was moving any troops now that winter had closed down, but the provinces of Tarika, New Northland, and West March were all firmly in the hands of Temple loyalists, who denounced the Republic's elected government as a lackey tool and minion of the accursed and excommunicate Carisian heretics. Between them, those provinces formed a blade thrusting into the Republic's heart, and Icewind was completely isolated from the rest of the country. The outcome was still very much in doubt in Hildamos province as well, and what happened there might well be critical. If Hildamos remained loyal to the Lord Protector, It would shield Glacier Heart from any attacks out of Westmarch and protect Old Province from attacks out of Westmarch and Tarika. More to the point, Mountain Cross Province was one of the eastern provinces which had gone over to Clintan. If Hildemoss held, a counterattack out of Northland and Old Province could almost certainly retake Mountain Cross. If Hildemoss fell, the rebels would be able to strike directly at the capital all along Old Province's northern frontier by early summer at the latest. Farther south, the Southmarch lands were a nightmare. Clintan and Reno had devoted special attention to the huge, sparsely populated area, but they'd been less successful than they'd hoped in bringing the regular army units over to their side. The entire province was actually one huge military district, divided into regional commands and administered by army officers. Indeed, one of the grievances Reno and Leon Bazkai's agitators had appealed to was the Southmarch's resentment that it hadn't yet been organized into provinces with representation in the chamber of the Senate. At least a third of the Southmarch commands had remained staunchly loyal to the Lord Protector and the central government, however, and the fighting was turning increasingly vicious. The rebels had also managed to seize control of the southwestern portion of Shiloh province, although it seemed unlikely they'd be able to hold on to it if Stonar survived the winter. Unfortunately, the rebels appeared to be aware of that, and the pogroms and killings in Shiloh were brutal almost beyond belief. If southwestern Shiloh was retaken by the government, it was going to be mostly one huge sea of gutted farms and burned-out ruins. For the moment, Southgard, Tranchar, and Winmore provinces were at least provisionally in the Lord Protector's column, although the situation in Southgard was confused and turning increasingly bloody. Atrocity begat atrocity, and bushwhackers and arsonists stalked one another mercilessly through the cold, rainy winter. The hate those attacks and counterattacks were generating was going to grow nothing but uglier, Merlin thought sadly. Indeed, it was the kind of violence and brutality that were likely to bequeath the multi-generational legacy of hatred among the survivors and their children. Malatar province had gone against the pattern for most of the rest of the Republic. The insurgents inside Marik, Malatar's provincial capital and Sidamark's second-largest seaport, had seized control of the entire city, and it had been the militias from the surrounding countryside which had fought their way back into Marik and crushed the rebels. Unfortunately, the city's entire Carisian quarter had been burned to the ground before the militias could retake Marik. There'd been very few survivors, and the reformist churches had suffered almost equally severely. Markan and Tranchar had held successfully for the Lord Protector and the government, and things were actually fairly quiet there. The same was true in Rowling's province, in the extreme northeast. Although the coastal area of Midhold province, between Rowling's and Old Province, had been the scene of some ugly fighting. The extreme western portion of Midhold was dominated by the successful rebels in Mountain Cross at the moment as well, which had to be causing a certain amount of anxiety in Siddar City. As far as anyone could tell, almost two-thirds of the regular army had honoured its oath to the Constitution and the Lord Protector. Several of those units which had remained loyal had been overwhelmed by the insurgency, unfortunately, and very few of those men had survived, since the temple loyalists weren't very interested in taking prisoners. Between defections, desertions, and combat losses, it was unlikely Stonar could call on more than a third, possibly as little as a quarter, of the once mighty Sidamachian army. Worse, the Grand Vicar had proclaimed Mother Church's support for the valiant children of God warring against evil and corruption in the Republic, and extended the jihad to anyone who supported the apostate and accursed Gregor Stonar and his minions. As a consequence,
volunteers were prepared to pour into the Western Republic from the border states as soon as weather permitted. For that matter, it was only a matter of time before actual contingents of the Temple Guard turned up. And, as Caleb had pointed out, Clintan had timed his uprising to coincide with the final stages of the Sidamachian harvest. The southern provinces harvested later, of course, but his attack had come before the produce from the agrarian west had been shipped east for the winter, and part of his strategy had included the deliberate destruction of foodstuffs, warehouses, farms, granaries, throughout the eastern provinces as well. By Owl's estimates, those provinces had lost almost half the food which would normally have carried them through the winter months. And at the very time the food supply had been interrupted, reformist and Carisian refugees from the west were pouring east in a desperate search for safety. "Do you think Stonar's going to make it through the winter, Merlin?" Charlian asked after a moment. "I think he's got a good chance," Merlin replied. "I don't know what's going to happen come spring, though. We're seeing an awful lot of orders from Makeware to the border states and the various Temple Lands military commands. I imagine he's planning on moving east to steamroller Stonar as soon as he can put an army in the field. And I expect Clintan's going to be suggesting to the Silkians that they'd better toe the line on the embargo from here on out if they don't want the same treatment the Republic just got. What's driving me and Dominic, Travis and Binzamin crazy is the fact that we still don't know what's going on up north," Caleb growled. "We can't do a thing, can't even establish contact with Stonar about this until we find out it's happening." "It won't be much longer, love," Charlian said, reaching out to lay a comforting hand on his shoulder. "We're already starting to hear rumours," she pointed out. "And all the world knows what a wonderful spy network we have." "I know," Caleb smiled crookedly at her. "That's what Travis and Binzamin and I are going to be talking about tomorrow morning. We're going to haul Alvino in as well and begin assembling relief shipments of food as a precaution, at Michael's suggestion," he grimaced. "Our economy's going to have the crap kicked out of it by the loss of so much Sidamachian trade. And if Silkia does decide it has to start paying attention to Clintan's embargo, that's only going to get worse. On the other hand, we'll suddenly have a lot of spare merchant galleons we can snap up to help ship in food and medical supplies. And if Stonar does make it through the winter and next spring, we may finally have the mainland ally we need," Merlin pointed out. "And if he doesn't make it through the winter and next spring, it's going to be at least 10 years before any other mainland realm is willing to stand up with us," Caleb said sourly. "Assuming, of course, that those returning archangels give us that long." "My, you are in a testy mood," Merlin observed mildly. "I've got a lot to be testy about," Caleb shot back. "This hasn't exactly been the easiest year we've ever had, you know." "Yes, I do know," Merlin said more gently. "But Hector has Iris, Davin, and Corris safely back aboard Destiny. They'll be headed home soon, and it should be interesting to see how Coruscant reacts when Corris and Iris tell them it was Clintan who had Hector murdered and tried to murder Davin as well. And for better or worse, Clintan's come out into the open on the mainland. This isn't just an overseas war for Howard and the Havens anymore. And that was his decision, not ours. In the long run, I think it's going to come home to roost with a vengeance, as long as Stonar does manage to hold. And Edward and Seamount have the new rifled guns in production, not to mention Mandrain's breechloaders. I know we all miss Mandrain, but that was a brilliant design approach, and the church isn't going to like it one bit when it runs into them in the field. Kint Clarick's about to suggest infantry mortars as well, and that's going to come as an unpleasant surprise to our friend Clintan, too. And then there's Edward's first steam engine. That's going to be a game-changer,
especially since we won't have to waste all that time tinkering and experimenting to improve it into a working proposition like they did back on old Terra. Are you trying to cheer me up by pointing out that the momentum is on our side? Caleb asked dryly. Because if you are, allow me to point out that for the next several months at least, the momentum's going to be rather solidly on Clintan's side in Sidamark. And if he knocks off the Republic, we'll be a long time looking for another opportunity to establish a foothold anywhere on the mainland. You are determined to be gloomy, Merlin said in a gently teasing voice. And no, I wasn't trying to tell you the momentum was on our side. I'm not even going to argue at this point that history is on our side, although I think it probably is. No, I'm just thinking about something you said a while back, Caleb. This has been a bad year in a lot of ways, but we're still here, and we're stronger than we were the year before. And the reason we are is that you and Charlie and Michael have laid a foundation here in Karis that someone like Zaspar Clintan will never be able to appreciate or match. Karis understands what this is about, and that's our strength, the bedrock that Clintan doesn't even begin to understand. These people, your people, recognize evil when they see it, and they're not willing to let it triumph. They refuse to see it triumph. They may not know all that we know, and they've damned well never heard of the Terran Federation or the Gababa, but they're ready to pay the price to buy their children's and their children's children's freedom from what Clintan represents, whatever that price is. And when you come down to it, Merlin smiled crookedly. We can work with that, you know. You do have a way of finding a bright side, don't you? What was it they called that back in the old days? A Pollyanna, I think, Caleb replied. But he was looking at his wife as he spoke, and he too smiled. He cupped one hand over the back of his sleeping daughter's head and hugged her gently, and then he nodded. But you're right, Merlin, he said softly. We can work with that.
We hope you've enjoyed How Firm a Foundation, a Macmillan audiobook from Tor Books. This program was produced and directed by Robert Kessler. Executive producer, Laura Wilson. Text copyright 2011 by David Weber. Production copyright 2011 by Macmillan Audio. All rights reserved.